Hello, this is Kid Congo Powers, and you are listening to The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Oh, well, hey, everyone. It's Nate. Thank you so much for joining us here. Episode 391 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, and I'm returning from a week off the show. It's been quite a crazy month between multiple episodes each week leading up to Record Store Day, and I lost my job. That's right, I got laid off of my day gig. So, yeah, lots is happening for me personally, and so I can tell you now is a great time for people to consider joining us, being a show sponsor at patreon.com/vinylguide. I could really use the support now more than ever. $5 or $10 or whatever you could spare each month is hugely appreciated while I once again hit the streets and try to find a new gig while balancing the podcast and all the requirements of that. I want to keep this podcast going, so please, if you're not a patreon.com/vinylguide supporter, please consider it now. In fact, we've got an extended version of this interview with Kid Congo Powers already up there. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and thank you so much in advance for your support. Now, this week, it's Kid Congo Powers talking all about his life around records, as a member of the Cramps, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, as well as a founding member of the Gun Club and author of the new book, Some New Kind of Kick. Kid Congo regales us with tales of music history, working with Lux and Ivy of the Cramps, what their record collection was like, what their reaction was to the many Cramps bootlegs, living with the Screamers, taking the Ramones record shopping, lots, lots more. It's a great chat with an absolute legend of punk music, Mr. Kid Congo Powers. And finally, we have nearly 400 episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast you may enjoy, including episode 384 with Steve Turner of Mudhoney, episode 387 with Perry Farrell and Eric Avery of Jane's Addiction, episode 372 with Jerry A. Lang of Poison Idea, episode 366 with Gerald V. Casale of Devo, episode 355 with East Bay Ray of Dead Kennedys, and lots more, including episodes featuring members of Metallica, Foo Fighters, OCs, Stone Temple Pilots, King Crimson, and more. You can enjoy them right now. Just subscribe or follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. So there we go. Let's get into today's conversation with Mr. Kid Congo Powers. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we are very honored to have Mr. Kid Congo Powers, who's celebrating his new book, Some New Kind of Kick. It's out now. It's available wherever you get your fine books. Digital versions are available as well. Of course, you can go to official kidcongopowers.com. Kid, how are you today? Great to see you, man.
Good. I'm good. Fixing my hair and... I'm at I'm at 2 p.m. wherever I am. I'm in Tucson, Arizona.
That's okay.
Where I live now. And good. I'm excited to be here.
Very good. Well, I'm in Sydney, Australia, and you've got a lot of very well-known ties to Australia. A lot of interesting things have happened with you in your travels to our country.
Oh, yes. going back to 1983 when the Gun Club played there. Actually, it was when I rejoined the Gun Club because they were doing a tour of Australia and half the band didn't show up to the tour, and so they called Jeffrey Lee Pierce, called me and said, "Can you come to Australia tomorrow?" And I said yes, and I was in a band with them ever since. Again, yes.
Now you've had such a rich history of all sorts of bands and been in the center of so many scenes, and you're a record collector, which is what the show is about. But this book, I've been reading this book, and it's quite fascinating. And I imagine trying to condense your life into these pages and writing it all down and having to revisit a lot of memories. Was it difficult for you? Was it an emotional process? How was it for you making this book?
Yeah, it was all of the above, and I was working on it from 2006 and then till 2021, so a long gestation period. So I had a lot of time to not steamroll through the whole thing at once. But it was kind of the thing where, actually, at points it got really uncomfortable to write about whatever I was writing about. I would jump out of my seat, just jump away, like literally, like be ejected out of my seat, and proclaim, "I have to make an album and go on tour for a year." And so it was really good for recording productivity because I got uncomfortable a lot when I was writing it. Jumped out of the seat and went on, made a record and went on tour for a year.
So do you find, writing an album, performing music, you feel best when you're starting from an uncomfortable state?
It's always an uncomfortable state because I'm kind of self-taught. So, and with music, especially with the Pink Monkey Birds, it is something we never discuss. We just get together and what happens happens, and people have songs, we write songs, but as far as a general direction, and we just let it happen as it happens, and it metamorphosizes. I had a real trouble doing the audiobook. Pronunciation. But it's a more to use a buzzword, organic process, that
Right.
takes it. It's a beast that has its own life, really.
That's interesting you bring that up because in the book, I recall you saying or mentioning something when you were playing with Nick Cave of the Bad Seeds. That was perhaps part of the thing that made that band tick. Nick liked to keep everyone a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit on edge, and apparently maybe he used that to his advantage. And then looking at some of the other bands you've been in, Cramps, Gun Club, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of comfortable moments there either.
No, I never knew that you should be comfortable. I didn't. I never. I looked from the start. I didn't learn that things would be comfortable when you were making music. I just assumed that it was always in this chaotic sort of non not no 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 one in the driver's seat, but the gas pedal going 100 miles an hour, and type of situation. And so, so like people are always like, "Why wasn't it crazy? You're the craziest people or the weirdest or the most intense." And I was like, "Well, I didn't know any different. I started with Jeffrey Lee Pierce and, going from there, Mux Interior and Nick Cave were a walk in the park, But,
Going back to your youth, was what did music mean to you? What were your first records, your first memories around music?
well, I grew up with, older sisters, two older sisters who are, preteens and teenagers when I was at my becoming into my own consciousness of recognizing things. And, I used to love my sister's records, and I used to know them by the label color, because I used to like to watch them spinning around. And before I could even read, I could tell what record was what by I knew which record was, "Expressway to Your Heart," by the Soul Survivors. I knew what that one was by the color, and I knew what "Satisfaction" by the Rolling Stones was because of the color of the record. And so, my identification with music was incredibly early on. And I grew up with, music in the house. I have Mexican American parents, and they played a lot of Mexican music, rancheras, music like Lucha Villa or Cucu Sanchez. And, I grew up hearing that. They loved Johnny Cash, They loved Janis. My mother loved Janis Joplin. So I had a quite a that. And then I was lucky enough to have a mentor, you know, neighbors who were teenage people who saw someone that ripe for corruption and as a young kid interested in something. And they, and, you know, and I just want a neighbor, Steve Escandon. He just immediately said, you have to listen to the Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, and, like, you know, introduced me to a Freak Out album and for the money. Those were like soup. I was, you know, in grade school, you know, or maybe junior high. And I was, you know, that was the thing. And he introduced me to things like R. Crumb comics and, you know, things underground.
Huge counterculture. I mean, were you the only kid at school that was kind of on this path?
I had these neighbors, and I had some other neighbors who had bands on the block, and you know, and I gravitated towards them. So I count myself lucky that they were around to show me the way and then drive me to shows before I had a driver's license. But yeah, so I had a lot of there was rock and roll on my and, you know, there was underground rock and roll, and then some of the younger, even younger kids, you know, they were, you know, into glam rock, and, you know, that's, and I found out about Mott the Hoople and Lou Reed and David Bowie, et cetera, you know, probably, you know, 73, I was 13, 14 years old, you know, and so, you know, and then I had cousins who were also in a band and music fanatics. And, you know, they turned me on to the likes of, you know, I was like 9 or 10 when I first heard Axis Bold as Love by Jimi Hendrix, you know, and I was really taken with that, you know, mostly because I wanted to be like my cousins and listen to what they listened to. But I dug the music, you know, I got into it. And yeah, so yeah, Black Sabbath, the same thing, you know. So I was exposed to a lot of different stuff early. So I knew there was a lot of different kinds of music. Also growing in my, then I, of course, mainstream music.
Yeah. And of course, growing up in Southern California, especially around this time, the radio was very versatile. So you got a taste of a little bit of everything.
FM radio, yes. And yeah, KLOS and stuff like that. Yeah. My friend who gave me the R. Crumb comics and Frank and the Mothers of Invention, yeah, was also into the Dr. Demento show, which is a well known now, an institution of funny, odd, weird music and humorous mostly. And that was really, had a big impression on a little kid because it was humorous.
I was in the same boat. I was in Northern California listening to Dr. Demento on Sunday nights, I think I recall. And, you know, with my cassette recorder trying to capture these songs, because God knows if I'd ever find them on record.
Pico and Sepulveda.
Well, I just remember, Fish Heads, Barnes and Barnes, and all, you know. So was there money around the house for records? Is that something that you spend a lot of time with, hanging around record stores?
There wasn't a lot of money. My mother was indulged me in things like Mad Magazine and I remember the first time that I bought a record that my parents gave me money to buy a record, a 99 cent record, was I bought Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones with Let's Spend the Night Together. And I remember I bought it because I don't even know if I knew the song, but I liked the cover. It was the Stones' Between the Buttons cover, you know, on 45, you know, and Keith, and I think it's Brian Jones is wearing these big sunglasses, like, you know, that cover his entire face, round fisheye sort of look. And I just thought, so cool. I'm going to get that record.
So you weren't aware of the song? You bought
it
from
the company? Well, I think I must have did. Yeah, it was on the radio. It was a hit song.
Okay. And what was the first song that you absolutely loved?
Wow. That's a hard question. I mean, it goes kind of, I don't know. That's a difficult question. Was it the Stones? I mean, Short Shorts. I used to play that. And I used to love that. I loved that song when I was a little kid.
So it sounds like from your book, you spent majority of your youth going to shows, getting in, being around the music scene. I mean, famously, you started the West Coast Ramones fan club. You saw a lot of shows. You even traveled quite a bit, but you didn't really pick up an instrument. So you never thought of yourself as a musician until much later.
No, not at all. It didn't occur to me in the least, because, that was something, you practiced for 14 years and then you made a song, I had these, like I said, I had these neighborhood friends, slightly older guys that were playing, and they just seemed so accomplished to me. It just seemed beyond anything I would, be able to handle. But I loved music so much, and I was certainly studying every move a rock star was making, and every sound, and you get a record, I knew every lyric to every song on every album that, I loved. And I it's kind of weirdly unconsciously practicing for becoming a musician. I had all the knowledge and all the and everything there was for it to happen, but I just wasn't a self-starter enough to decide that would happen for me, and also I thought that rock stars are rock stars, they are untouchable, they're special people, they're before punk rock, a rock star you would never imagine probably even meeting, or the best you could hope for is that you waited backstage and you would see them in sunglasses and a giant overcoat being bundled into a limousine, and if you stuck your piece of paper out, they scribble a name on it, and that was as much as that was a rock star to me, and that was another world that I didn't even consider. I was like, oh, that's definitely not me.
But you knew you wanted to at least be in that cloud somehow. I mean, starting the fan club, it's you're kind of moving from purely listener and fan to participant, an active kind of member of that community.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the thing is that, like I said, it was probably very unconscious that I was studying for this, but also, the way in, it was good because punk rock made it doable. The Ramones made it doable. And it was miraculous that the Ramones would play a show and then would walk into the audience after, start talking to people and asking them, how do we find, the used record store, or where's the good thrift store, or where do I find comics? And can you take me there? We don't have a car. Can you take me there? And that was a very different situation then. And that kind of, that you said, like, oh, this is their normal people, and they're still rock stars, but they are approachable and accessible, and maybe they aren't so, maybe this whole rock star thing isn't so untouchable, and this whole and then the punk revolution, the explosion happened, and people were just picking up guitars and going for it, without trying. The idea was king, you know, more than the technical ability, you know. And so when, you know, after a little bit of punk, when I realized all this and had a Ramones fanzine and whatnot, and you know, Jeffrey Lee Pierce just said, you should be in a band, you know, like anyone would say to anyone in 1977. And I was like, oh, that is no. Yeah. My first was like, no, not going to happen. Yeah. I'm going to be a journalist or I'm going to do something else, but I'll be an A&R person. But then he just like believed, he just was insistent. And I thought, well, if this person believes I can do it, I guess I should try it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a band. Then the next day we had a band.
And so the first time you really put on a guitar and really kind of thought of yourself as this is now going to be something I pursue. How long was it between that moment and when you guys played your first show in front of people?
It was pretty quick. It was pretty quick. You know, luckily Jeffrey Lee Pierce, you know, was armed with some songs and ideas, you know, for all of this. And this is when we did talk a lot about music, you know, and we'd both been to New York and seeing what was going on there with, you know, we had seen, by this time we'd seen the Cramps and James Chance and the Contortions. And this was something that was really interesting to us, you know, to mix, because being both record collectors, you know, that we, that, you know, that mixing of styles, the crashing of worlds in styles of music was so appealing, you know, when we saw the Cramps, you know, it was, you know, nowadays you could say, you know, anyway, you know, rockabilly mixed with psychedelic music, and it's kind of normal. That's of a thought. But when I saw them, that was just something from fucking outer space. You know? Like, I was like, what is going on here? You know, not to mention the visuals that go with it. But, you know, and that was all it. It was an all-encompassing thing. And you were, you know, converted on the spot. I mean, they were a brand new band without records, and the whole audience was screaming and going crazy, you know, at CBGB. And, you know, it was a, you know, they were just it, you know, it just was visceral. And the same thing with James Chance and the Contortions, a very similar situation, but like mixing, you know, whatever, James Brown with Albert Eiler with punk, you know. Mm-hmm. it was completely revolutionary.
So you've experienced the Cramps in multiple ways, even, you know, obviously even part of the band, but seeing them in New York versus seeing them in LA, was it kind of a different band depending on that kind of those polar parts of the US?
Not in the least. They just were them, you know, and they and the audience reacted exactly the same way. You know, people like, you know, lie down in the street and die. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess like more like you thought, like, is this going to turn into a riot or an orgy? I'm not sure which. Something in between, I guess.
You know, either way, I'm sticking around.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm getting in that band. And yeah, so that was the whole thing. It was like they were so confounding, but so immediately, you know, it's dangerous and sexy and funny and it was a whole world, you know, in one club set, you know, with no records, you were completely knew what exactly what this whole world was about, you know. They were an immediately fully formed concept, you know.
I do want to explore Cramps more and definitely Gun Club. Before we do, another band around this time that you were around quite a bit is the Screamers. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of recorded material from the Screamers.
Yeah.
Was there any discussion with the bands about doing more recordings than they did, or that have eventually come to light?
Well, that I wasn't in the band, so I'm not privy to all of that.
But you were roommates, right? I mean,
I lived in their house and in a group house with them, and they were looking into the future, you know, and they were futurists, and they were thinking like, you know, video is going to be the thing. Video is going to be, and they were correct, but they didn't get as far as the video revolution or MTV or anything. They broke up before that even happened, but they had that idea that, you know, that was going to be the future. And, you know, it was a highly, even just kindly conceptual art band, you know, and they really were sticking to their vision. And this is the whole thing, you know, that they had a real vision, you know, for what they were and how they presented themselves and what kind of music they'd make. And, you know, that they did record some stuff. I mean, recently on Super Viaduct, some demos came out, like really remastered, and they're really amazing. And also, and I actually just talked to the guy, and he, Steve, and he said that there's actually more. So, that they're figuring it all out.
Wow,
the great vinyl shortage is making everything wait a long time.
I'm sure there's a pressing plant out there that'll put that in the front of the line if they get a chance to.
Exactly.
But yeah, okay, all right. So that makes a lot of sense, because the Screamers, that I think it's the Target video that they have, is revolutionary. It's, you watch it today, you're like, God, I want to watch 10 hours of this.
Yeah. You know, I didn't miss a show. You know, I traveled to New York to see them, or up and down the coast. You know, it was an incredible live show. You know, so charismatic and energizing and theatrical and you just love it. Was just amazing, and the fact that it is so smallly documented is a shame, but also it makes them as mysterious and special as they set out to be, you know.
Good on you
Screamers.
That's part of the delight of the Screamers. Yeah, what do they say? Always leave them wanting more.
Yes, exactly.
I can't remember if this is in your book or if this is something I've heard, picked up here or there. Is it true Keith Morris gave the band, the Gun Club, the name of the band?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best, and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. I can't remember if this is in your book or if this is something I've heard, picked up here or there. Is it true Keith Morris gave the band, the Gun Club, the name of the band?
That is very true, and it's actually in the book.
Okay.
Yeah, Keith Morris was very good friends with Jeffrey Lee Pierce, the Gun Club. And so we had a first name called The Creeping Ritual, which we thought was hilarious. And because we were like, you know, into Dr. John, this is where this is coming from, that name was coming from. But Keith was, that sounds too much like you're trying to be a gothic band, you know, so you should have a different name. And he gave us a couple of unmentionable names. And then one of them was the Gun Club, you know, and you have to read the book if you want to see what they were. Actually, one of them was the Ass Festival, which I thought was great. The Gun Club was almost called the Ass Festival. Might not have had the same success if we had it.
Or it could have been.
Or maybe better, yes.
That one would have looked really good at the top of the bill.
Like, yeah.
Okay. And for his efforts.
Some promoter should call their festival the Ass Festival.
We're not that far from it. So, and for his efforts, I think Keith was rewarded with one of with a song for the Circle Jerks.
Yeah, Jeffrey gave him the song Group Sex that he had written. So it was an even trade.
This became the
title of the first Circle Jerks album.
So at one point, you strapped on the guitar. You started playing with the Gun Club. There was a Gun Club album, and then you left and joined the Cramps. Is that the sequence?
Yeah, the sequence is that I left to join the Cramps, and then I got right before the Gun Club made their first album. So there was all the songs I played on that ended up on the Fire of Love album, the first album. But they had gotten, I had left the band and joined the Cramps, and where Dotson became the main guitar player, and he recorded the album and was in the band for some years. So,
right.
Yeah, he was the member.
Okay, all right. So you wrote a lot of Fire of Love, but didn't play on it.
I wrote a couple songs, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you had this offer from Lux to join the Cramps, and you'd been playing for, remind me, what, about a year, year and a half at this point?
A year, yeah, about.
Okay.
And they came, apparently a friend of ours suggested that they were looking for a guitar player because Brian Gregory, the first guitarist, had left, and they were actually moving to Los Angeles, was something I wasn't aware of. They had already made that decision. So they were looking in Los Angeles for a guitar player. And some friends, mutual friends of ours, suggested they go see me. They said, oh, they're kind of a Crampsy type thing. And, you know, they have a song about Ivy, and, you know, you should go see them, you know. And as Lux showed up with a cassette recorder and a microphone and taped the show, and that was my audition. And like, you know, a week later, I just got some knock on my door, and it was Ivy and Lux, and they came in and said, do you want to be in our band? And I was like, well, you know, I would like such a thing to happen. And I said, what would you sacrifice to be in our band? Because I said, like, what do I do? Do we audition? Do I need to audition? What do you want to do? I said, no, but we just have to answer one question. What would you sacrifice to be in the band? And I said, like what? Like quit my band, quit the Gun Club, or relocate, or quit going to college, or whatever I was doing at the time. And they said, no, nothing like that. I said, would you cut your finger off to be in the Cramps? And I said, yes, I would. And they said, okay, you're in the band, like, come to rehearsal next week. And that was it.
They just wanted to see your commitment. There was no chopping block.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Let me keep the finger.
So between that point and recording what became Psychedelic Jungle, was there a lot of rehearsal? Was there a lot of preparation? What was that road like?
Yeah, there was. There was a lot of rehearsing, and they were writing some new songs, you know, for it. You know, we did a lot of covers on that record, but there was new songs, and they are kind of reconfiguring older songs, you know, and I was learning everything all you know, on the job, you know, like, and Ivy was, they were great teachers and very generous with their magic, you know, and, mm-hmm. and showing me, and patience, showing me how the songs that they already had went. And, you know, Ivy gave me a fuzz pedal, which I'd never played before, and taught me to use it like a horn. And she said, like, just think of it like a horn, like a saxophone, you know, you're squawking and punctuating, and, you know, every once in a while let loose with some wild whale, you know. And and that was a great teaching, and it made complete sense to me, you know, as a self-taught, you know, untaught person, you know. If you could give me an example like that, you know, that's like, wow, yeah. Say no more.
Wow.
So there was actually a lot of preparation, but it all happened very quickly. I mean, it's all kind of a blur. It was all, things were moving fast.
Yeah.
In 1980.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you joined Cramps, they were still kind of the label darlings. The label had their back, and they were, issues aside of what was happening, you know, in the accounting department, the label had big plans for the Cramps. And then
Miles Copeland loved the Cramps. Yeah. Yeah.
Miles Copeland.
Yeah. And he loved the Cramps so much. And, you know, whatever, you know, business and friendship doesn't mix, they say. So that was, you know, that was something that was beyond my, I was the young hired hand, you know. All the vision and business was up to Lex and Ivy, you know. And, you know, I felt grateful that I was let in on that vision a bit, you know. And, but, you know, that was kind of the end of my thing when that started happening, when they got into all the legal hassles with the label and refusing to record more until only on their own terms. And, you know, again, it was a bold and a great lesson in making music that they were not going to pander to what people wanted of them, and that their vision was to be defended at all costs, you know. And even if that meant, like, we won't record anything then, you know, or we'll just play live, you know, thing, you know, this kind of thing, that, you know, this was a valuable lesson to me, you know. And it's something that, you know, Nick Cave has done, that does, and the Gun Club the same. So it was very much like, make it, what is making it, you know? Actually, it's like, listen to someone else, forget it.
What good is a new car if you don't have dignity?
Exactly.
did you, when you were in the Cramps, did you feel as a band member, someone that they would talk to, maybe even not a decision maker necessarily, but did you feel like part of that mob, or did you feel a little bit like the new guy or a hired guy?
I felt, well, I'm tenacious enough to feel just to jump in, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were friendly people. They were the most friendly people, you know. Peculiar, but who isn't, you know? but like I said, just very strong, self confidence and vision, you know. But they were super nice to me, and super, I didn't have a terrible time with them, except that, you know, it was a little prescriptive, you know, to that, you know, they had some ground rules that were like, you know, don't talk to anyone else. you know, definitely don't play with anyone else, you know.
Yeah.
And that was a bit alien to me. And after a while, especially when things were winding down, when the lawsuits started to happen, and I was itching to do something else, and it just so happened that they wanted to change everything you know, they were like, we don't know what we're doing now. You know, we're not making a record. We're not, you know, blah, 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 you know. So it was kind of an easy way to fire me without making me feel bad.
Yeah. Maybe it's time for you to go be yourself.
Exactly. Yes.
now the Cramps are so bootlegged. And yeah. And I know Ivy and Lux are also record collectors. We're also, you know, they had a marvelous collection from what I understand. Amazing. Yeah. What do you remember about their record collection?
You know, very organized, you know, very organized, you know, I'm talking 45s, you know, miles of 45s, it seemed like, you know, and very well organized and well taken care of, and every kind of rock and roll, you know, amazing doo-wop collection, amazing rockabilly, of course, collection, psychedelic music, you know, exotic music, you know, just everything, you know, and you know, novelty records.
You know. Would you go record shopping with them? Would you
sometimes they'd get everything good, but they weren't beyond getting reissues. You know, all those like Nuggets and Pebbles albums and things. You know, those held the. You know, if the song was on there, the song was on there, you know, they could later look for the 45, you know, or they probably had them already, you know.
They had a lot of 45s. They focus on 45s, and you focus on 45s, is that right?
Yeah, I do now. Yeah, I do in my DJ world, you know. I DJ dance parties that are mostly, you know, from the 50s to the 80s, really, but centered on wild music from the, you know, 50s, a lot of soul screamers, a lot of stompers, a lot of, you know, and this is my thing, the back to inciting a riot. I'm like, is this record going to, does this have the potential to incite a riot? If so, I'm going to play it out. If it doesn't, I might not. I probably won't play it.
Where do you find a lot of these records?
Every kind of way, you know. I go, you know, digging record stores, you know, digging in thrift stores, digging at flea markets, digging at record swap meets, digging. You know, the usual outlets, I think. I don't have any special other ways, you know, and it's all these days very much luck of the draw. And again, I think my upbringing of knowing records by their labels, color and thing and style, I'm really sometimes if it looks great, I'll get it just because I have a feeling this will be good because of all the elements, you know, that the label looks good. The song title seems good. The band seems good. The writing credits are good. You know, they don't say like, you know, orchestra arranged by or, you know, just like or whatever, you know, it looks offbeat, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's worth a gamble.
Sometimes the record that you don't know just kind of glows and just tells you, take me home, you know, because you know something special's on it.
Yeah. I found that, well, a couple of years ago, I found one of my favorite records. I was in Richmond, Virginia at Steady Sounds, and I was looking at 45s, and it was just kind of in a pile of stuff that was like kind of the whatever pile, and I found a record that just looked great, and I got a kind of car on it, a classic car sort of on it, and it was by the Fugitives, and it was Bo Diddley, and I was like, oh, what is this? And I got it. It's great. It's this instrumental and crazy garage rock version, you know, old 60s version, and I found out they were actually a local Richmond, Virginia band, you know. So that's the kind of thing, like, you know, sometimes it just popped out at me. I was like, all these records, and then suddenly I was like, oh, look at this. So it's a magic solution. Yes.
What's the most you've ever paid for a single record?
I don't know. I'm pretty cheap. You know, I'm not someone who wants to spend a lot of money on a record. Well, any record now is too much money, you know. But these days, what did I buy for? I did buy something recently just for $50, and I thought that was a lot for a 45. And I'm trying to think of what it was. I can't remember, but I
could. Okay. So $50 is that's the
problem. Yeah. I'm not, I'm a collector, but I'm also sloppy and reckless. So I don't want to buy, I don't mind buying the scratchy version of it. You know, I like playing scratchy records.
More character.
Exactly. Yeah. More work.
They've lived a more interesting life.
Yeah. It's just a choice.
Now, a lot of your records that you've been on go for far, far more than $50.
Scratchy or not.
That's right. So do you know what the most collectible record in the Kid Congo universe is?
I have no idea. I pay no attention to that kind of thing. I see them. I see Cramps records mostly that are, you know, Goo Goo Muck single. There's a very rare yellow Goo Goo Muck 12-inch that I just autographed it recently, and I was like, what? I don't even know what it was. I was like, is this some bootleg or something? And they said, no, it was an IRS like promo thing, you know.
And oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so it exists. Unless they were lying to me. But I don't see why they would have any reason.
There's a good reason why. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a good chance.
Yeah, the Cramps are the most collectible. The Gun Club, that doesn't fetch a big price for some reason. But they might. I don't know. I just don't know.
Some of them do, actually.
Actually, it was very hard to get the original Sex Beat 45, the first 45. That was
right.
That goes for a bit. It was just recently reissued in a box set.
Right.
But I think that went probably Fire of Love first. Yeah, because that has gone through so many covers and, you know, I mean, record jackets, you know, and reissues, you know.
Yeah.
Gun Club is a very reissued band.
Do you know if all the master tapes of Gun Club exist? Is that what they're taking all the reissues from?
I think they do exist. No, Jeffrey's sister, Jackie, is the, you know, the head of the estate of Jeffrey, and so she has them all, and these reissues sound great, you know. Recently one for the Las Vegas story just came out, and great artwork had came out with a live, the CD came out with like three CDs, two CDs, an album, then a live show, and a DVD of Super 8 home movies that Terry Graham, had taken. So, who complained and quit the band because he said all of his tapes were stolen because we got robbed on tour, like happens. And then this comes out. I'm like, you didn't lose all of them.
Yeah.
But maybe it was just one reel, so. I sympathize with Terry and I'm friendly with him, so that's fun.
So definitely, Cramps are quite collectible. Gun Club, especially Fire Love, the ones on Ruby, those are collectible. But Kid Congo and Pink Monkey Birds, five greasy pieces.
That's a rare one. Yes,
that is
box set of singles. That was. We wanted to release the album Gorilla Rose in some kind of different kind of way than just the album and CD. And so we came up with the idea of five singles that will be on the album tracks, five of the album tracks, but with five cover versions for B-sides. Mm-hmm. And that was a little box set. We were trying to get it into a chicken bucket, but We couldn't find the right size of one to get. Box set.
Wait a minute. Didn't you have some that were where the record, the artwork was silk screened on beer cardboard on a beer?
Oh, pack? Yeah, that too. That was the Conjure Man 45. And we had a silk screener in Lawrence, Kansas. Yeah, and then she got, because she did posters and artwork on the back of beer crate, a beer, you know, boxes, you know, the 12 pack of beer comes in, you know, and so she used the back of those to silk screen onto. And we said, wow, you know, this is, could be perfect. You could make a perfect 7-inch single, you know, fold over with this. So that was good. Yeah, we you know, artwork is great. Special artwork is great for records. Oh. That's the great thing about Larry Hardy and In the Red Records. He's all for packaging. You know, he is the weirder thing you could think of, but he's into it.
You know? No idea is too out there.
Nah.
So with the Cramps and bootlegs, because there were so many bootlegs of the Cramps, what was the feeling at the time of the band and these bootleggers? Was it adversarial? Was it supportive?
No, they hated it, you know, because, you know, it's they didn't get the money for it. That's right. One thing, you know, it's your work and someone else is profiting from it. You know, it was, you know, the thing is the Cramps fans have had a big appetite for bootlegs, for any minutia piece of anything, you know. And so I mean, I see the fanaticism, and they went at it with love, for sure, for love of the band. It wasn't, you know, to undermine the band that they bought these bootlegs, you know, but it's more the manufacturer they were not happy about. But those were the days of that were fun, because you go to a record swap meet and see your album, and you just go up to the seller and say, give me those. You know, they could really not say anything about it. Especially if you were Lux Interior.
So he would do that. He'd go to like the Capitol Records swap meet and just, yeah, there'd be, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Hand them over, you know.
What would he do with them? Would he sell them or throw them in the garbage?
Yeah, I hope so. One would hope so.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. I mean, I want to be respectful of your time here. And, but there's so many different parts of your career that are fascinating. And just getting into this book, again, there's so many great names. And we haven't even talked really about Nick Cave much. An Australian legend, you worked with Tex Perkins.
Oh, I love Tex. Yes.
Yeah.
Tex, Mr. Texy, Sexy Texy. We tried to make one band, the Fur Bible, but it didn't quite gel. We later got together and made The Butcher Shop, you know, which was a great record. Spencer P. Jones, and it was a really fun thing. And yeah, Tex is a super talent. I remember him when he was in Tex Deadly and the Dum Dums before the Beast of Bourbon. You know, yeah. I first met him in '83 when I met him when I came with the Gun Club. And I was like, oh, this kid's fucking superstar, you know. He just knew immediately, you know, first yeah. voice and the look, you know. He was, you know, he was and charisma, you know, that the X factor, you know. He had it immediately. Yeah, you could see this kid was like, oh yeah, or a fully fledged already made star, you know. Just wait, people just have to hear it, you know.
Yeah.
And once they heard it, it happened.
if only that charisma helped him get through customs occasionally.
Oh, yeah. It endeared him to me.
There's a everyone, you know what we're talking about, there's a great story in the book about Tex Perkins getting stuck in UK customs. Mm-hmm. That's worth the price of the book in itself, just for that anecdote.
It certainly is. Yeah, it was hilarious. Maybe not so hilarious at the time, but in retrospect.
Yes. One of those, one day we'll look back on this and laugh moments. Hey, look, kid, I've had a wonderful time hanging out here, talking a bit of records with you. I wish you luck in your record hunting later this afternoon.
Yes.
Hopefully you'll find what you're looking for. I want to remind folks, Kick Congo's new book, Some New Kind of Kick, is available now. Pick it up. A lot of great stories in there, some really hidden history of punk rock and music from an absolute legend. Again, Kid Congo, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
Having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, there he is, Mr. Kid Congo Powers. And again, his book is great. I highly recommend checking it out. Lots more tales in there. We only scratched the surface today. And by the way, we've got an extended version of this interview available only up at patreon.com/vinylguide. I always put extra stuff up there. Here we've got an extra 10 minutes with Kid Congo, as well as it's high resolution and commercial free, and it goes to support me doing this podcast. So that's patreon.com/vinylguide, and thank you so much in advance for your support. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes across social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, share them in the Reddit forums and the Facebook punk rock groups. Please put these episodes out there and help your friends subscribe to The Vinyl Guide. That is very appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.